Hi, everyone. Welcome to a new episode of Tech Can't Save Us podcast, brought to you by Literal Humans. As always, I am Paul David, co-founder and CEO of Literal Humans. I'll pass it over to Will.
And I'm William Gadsby-Pete, other co-founder and chief strategy officer.
And we are joined today by Billy Simmons, co-founder of Daylight. Welcome to the pod, Billy.
Thanks so much for having me. You both have very calming, relaxing voices. Really enjoyable.
It's only in this first bit, and then I get overly excited by whatever we're talking about, and suddenly I go like full like 100 mile a minute and say the word like in between every sentence. And I hadn't realized that until listening back to a couple of these podcasts and realizing I hate my voice, I hate my cadence, and oh my God, I've been putting my friends and family through this the last 30 years.
There are only listeners. That's why. That's fine. Working on that, though.
My mom doesn't listen to this.
Oh, man. Billy, give our audience just kind of a high-level synopsis of, who you are and what you do, and, what brings you to the show today.
Sure. As I mentioned, I'm the co-founder of Daylight. We are a financial services company targeted towards the LGBT community, and we're building financial tools to help the LGBT community live their best lives. We started off with a neobank product. And our latest thing that we've launched about a month ago now is family building tools to help queer people have children more quickly and more cheaply.
Amazing. I have to ask this at the top of the show. Are you named after another great Philadelphian, Billie Holiday?
I'm actually named after my great uncle, who is also a Billy. And it's obviously not a very common name in England, but for some reason it's become a family name in my family. I wish I was named after Billie Holiday.
Very cool.
That'd be much cooler.
Just go for it. Late next time.
Yeah.
Did your great uncle achieve any cool things to have your namesake?
He got the Victoria Cross?
Okay, that's pretty bloody impressive.
Wow. Yeah.
Wow. Really slumming it as a tech founder there in terms of.
I know. I've got big things to achieve to match up.
Let's jump in, as we do at the top of every Tech Can Save Us episode, jump into the headlines. We shared a piece with you from USA Today about the LGBT community and, just like the size of the community in Gen Z. And super curious, you're in fintech, kind of at the cutting edge of both the LGBT community, the youth movement and also, technology. So just curious, like, what you think about this greater representation and how it's connected to your company, its mission and its overall approach to its work.
Yeah, I mean, we've had data indicating the kind of generational shift towards many, many more people identifying as LGBT pretty much since the beginning of Daylight. And one of the reasons that that has been really useful data for us is because it's essentially an ever expanding audience for us to be serving. And, what it really indicates is more and more people, as in the younger generations, are thinking about societal structures, expectations of things like heterosexuality and monogamy and discarding them and saying, I don't want to do that. And so what I think is really interesting is we're going to have an entire generation of people for whom all of the rules have been kind of thrown out and they get to start from scratch, which is an incredibly exciting thing for a generation to choose to do. That makes it sound like it's a choice, but to sort of get to do, I suppose. And it's exciting for us because that means we get to build things with that in mind. Like, what does a joint bank account look like when there are three of you in a throuple? What does it look like when more and more people are identifying as trans and non-binary? What does that mean for things like fertility and family building? These are things that then you have to start preparing for much, much earlier. So I actually think, it's great. And I think it's exciting to see what societal structures Gen Z will tear down.
Yeah, I have to say at the top of the show that this episode is particularly exciting for me. I don't know if you can see I wore like the gayest shirt I could with my Reading Rainbow shirt, but I don't think I've shared this with the audience before, but I have queer parents. So I grew up with two dads. And, I remember pretty viscerally when one of my dads got sick and was on the verge of passing away, that my other dad had a difficult time getting into his finances and getting, because of the laws that exist and stuff like that. So sort of leads me to a question for you, Billy, around like, how have you, through this fintech that you're now operating, helped the LGBT community navigate, the rules that are still and the laws that are still, to some degree, not really in their favor, oppressive in some cases. We've obviously seen a resurgence of that in the US. So yeah, just super curious how you're helping, your customers navigate that.
Yeah, I think it's kind of threefold for us. So the first is where we can, we're building technology to help them access systems that are designed specifically for them. So a great example is our sort of flagship feature on our neobank product is the ability to have whatever name you want on that card. It doesn't have to match your legal ID. There's no red tape. It's literally like you update your profile in the app and you can issue a new card in that name.
Real quick, what's the coolest name that you've seen on a card so far?
Someone had the sparkle emoji as their last name. And that was like genuinely, you know, how they wanted to have their last name be represented, which I thought was just super cool. Because again, it's like totally throwing out all of these ideas about even what a last name is. I thought that was really cool. Unfortunately, it isn't Unicode, so we actually couldn't print it. So that was really unfortunate.
But update that feature is there.
Sometimes we're still constrained.
There's
something in the future for us there. But yeah, so, you know, helping with technology where we can, helping with education and sort of foresight planning. So, you know, a huge one for us with the family building product is a lot of people don't realize that there are a ton of legal complexities to having children if you are LGBT. Or they vaguely know, but they don't know what things they need to have, you know, in place. Things like second parent adoption, things like estate planning, like things like that. So we help, you know, our members understand what it is that they need to have in place in order to protect themselves and their family. And then the final one is, you know, a lot of these things are outside of our control as a company. These are big societal and legislative changes that need to happen. But I think as we scale as a company, our ability to advocate for our community increases. And so, you know, my co-founder Rob has been down at the White House over the past couple of months advocating for the trans community when it comes to data protection and privacy in banking. We've done a huge amount of campaigning and advocacy around the ability to have your chosen name on your card and that process. I've worked with credit unions because when you change your first name legally, your credit score breaks in the US. And so, like, trying to work on solutions around that. So, you know, I think there's a tremendous amount of good that we can do just by being a large, successful company and having a position in society where people want to listen to us and want to learn from us.
You probably couldn't have chosen a sector that is more often a little bit behind the times, like, you know, in terms of like it's so in need of your service. Like, you know, I won't name it because that seems a little harsh, but like my bank, when, like, you know, when I fill in certain forms and it's like male, female, prefer not to say, and you're like, oh, that feels a little bit like 1995, bro. Like, you haven't come up to even come to that far. You know, like, the idea that you're going to be doing banking properly for folk that aren't, you know, heteronormative is very unlikely. So yeah, I mean, like, all really just say, like, a really happy day like exists. Like, it, yeah, it's it couldn't be more needed. You must be so intensely into the involved, or probably more than any, like, banks are already pretty intense with data, but for you it must be such an extra level of importance to look after that data, because, you know, in the wrong hands it can be, especially in the States at the moment, the current political climate, couldn't be more fraught.
Yeah, I mean, we have to take that, you know, you would have to take that super seriously regardless, particularly for our community. It's incredibly important. And it's something that we think a lot about, even with things like design. Do people want a bright yellow card that, you know, if you recognize it, can indicate that you're LGBT? You know, in certain environments, we've received feedback that we're definitely taking on, you know, of like, you know, this thing actually, you know, outs me, and that's like a difficult problem to solve. The solve that we would probably do, but we have not yet been able to do, is like alternative branding for different cards. Like, you can have a black version of the card or a gray silver version or something, so that it's sort of discreet. But yeah, you know, it's really interesting, like, even the chosen name feature, particularly for black LGBT people, they're often at point of sale challenged in general, not just with the daylight card, but, you know, do you have an ID that matches the card that you've got? Because the presumption is they've stolen the card. And so we're, you know, often we're thinking about, you know, what are all of these other intersectional societal structures that we have to kind of contend with? And how do we build specific products for our community without actually inadvertently making their lives harder, or just like adding another level of complexity? I'm very lucky that this gets to be my day job and I get to solve these problems as my job, but it's it can be tough sometimes to figure it out.
So cool as well for a bank to care that much. You know, most banks' approach is, well, we give you a bank account, we give you a card, and, you know, we don't get, like, to really actually care about the social issues and the life that those people are living, and the things that that bank allows them to do is just very cool.
You can't do anything without money, right? And so that's actually why we, you know, I mean, I've worked in fintech most of my career, so this was kind of a natural industry evolution for me. But yeah, in terms of serving this community with products, like, you know, you can't go anywhere these days without using your debit card somewhere, or like a credit card or some kind of financial product to do anything in your life, to progress in your life, to achieve life goals. There's a financial transaction almost always involved. And so, you know, that it's, to us, it's like, that's, it's so core to all of our lives that I think that's why I wanted to start in this area.
It does seem as well like something that's only going to get more pronounced, you know, like I fully expect the only thing that Web3 will, the first thing that will break through with Web3 is the concept of wallets, where, you know, you have a digital wallet that is not just something you pay for with, but also contains a huge amount of like you digitally as a footprint, you as a person, you know, it's essentially you. And I think that, yeah, more and more, your phone, bank account, everything is going to be in one smart device that sort of unlocks your access to the world and how you engage with it.
Yeah. And then what does it mean to have one device, one wallet that your entire life is controlled in and your entire identity is held in? Like, what does that mean for like the rigidity of identity in technology? I don't have an answer to that, but
yeah, Jesus,
we're
only 10 minutes in when we've already got existential angst.
Well, we've kind of danced around it, but like, yeah, I would love to just dig into Daylight, you know, as a company, as a product. I would love to hear a bit about your inspiration for creating it and kind of where it stemmed from and just kind of your ultimate goal there.
So my light bulb moment for Daylight was talking to my co-founder and essentially getting user interviewed about my experiences as a trans woman in the US accessing financial services. I transitioned while I was in the US. So I'm like, even though I grew up in England, hence the accent, most of my adult life, most of my transness and queerness has been centered in America. And I realized that I had normalized a ton of very unpleasant and frankly, at times unsafe experiences doing things like updating my name on my card. You know, to do that, I had to not only spend a whole bunch of time and money getting my name updated, like legally, but then I had to take that document that essentially says, hi, I'm a trans person. This is my old name. This is my new name. Please don't discriminate against me and give me a card, to every single financial institution that I banked with and a notary. And there was no way to do that without outing myself and without physically going somewhere too. And I think that's also the other element of this often, and where tech could save us, for example.
Well done.
Is, you know, there are times where like human interaction is really valuable, of course, and human design is really valuable, but there are also times where technology allows us a level of abstraction where we don't have to interact with people and therefore we do not need to be beholden to that individual person's opinions, beliefs, and biases. And so it allows us, you know, I think there always needs to be a combination of these two elements. But the fact that I had to go into a bank, and I was transitioning in New York, like it's a pretty liberal place, like in general, but you are essentially going up to a person and saying, I really hope that you're not transphobic and that you're going to help me here, because yes, you have policies as a company, but like, I'm still relying on you as an individual to help me. So yeah, so that was the kind of the original impetus. And you know, our mission at its core is to help LGBT people live their best lives. And, you know, kind of going back to what I was saying earlier, with money kind of being the gateway to self-actualization for so many parts of our LGBT identity, whether it's having children, whether it's transness, whether it's retirement, which costs more on average for an LGBT person, money is at the root of all of these differences. And money is the way that we're going to access all of these things. So we built this neobank product and ran that for about 2 years. And, you know, I think it's a tough industry to run a neobank in, to be totally, you know, candid, in America, in this economy and that kind of thing. And so what was important to us was to figure out what was the next thing that we could build that was going to drive value to our community. The one that was kind of the perfect Venn diagram of affects the most number of LGBT people, is a core differentiator and is something where that LGBT identity directly affects their ability to access something, and could potentially be a revenue generator for us, was family building. And so that's, you know, it's an incredibly complex, expensive, legal minefield, logistical minefield, emotional minefield. And so we're starting to solve that through technology, but also through humans. We have a concierge service. you can access that is essentially like a coach for this journey. And we will help you figure out your next step, figure out what legal things you need to have in place, but also be there if you just need to vent about how frustrating this process is. We also have community features so that you can, you know, the kind of end goal for the community feature is like, I'm a gay man in my 40s and I'm having a child that is arriving summer 2024. We're going to put you in a Discord channel with a bunch of other queer parents, ideally even from the same demographic, having children at the same time, so that we can start to build these offline communities and support systems as well.
That's really powerful. Like what you're saying is resonating on a couple levels, but like the idea of building product in a company around a community and like the specific issues they face, and the piece about, you know, being thoughtful about all the different points in which money becomes an issue, or, you know, folks in the queer community are forced to out themselves in various ways, really resonates with me. You know, as I mentioned, what I experience in terms of, you know, watching my dad's struggle. Like I wish my dad had a way where he could just be like, hey, I don't have to go to, you know, my other dad's family and ask them for permission to my partner's estate, you know, like, and if that could have been solved through tech, that would have been amazing for him. And that would have made, you know, a very painful moment in his life that much easier to get through, because, you know, he was had a program like Daylight or something like that. And also to your point about the donation process, I've been involved in a couple, you know, donor experiences, and just watching, you know, the folks I was working with in those processes, like, really struggle with like donation banks and like, you know, the like legal aspect of it and the amount of money that it takes. Like the fact that you have this concierge service and you're solving these issues for these folks is really powerful. And I think it's just like a testament to building like true tech for good. Like, you know, that is like, hey, here's a social problem that millions of people are facing, and we're going to build tech around solving those problems with them, for them. So yeah, kudos to you for that, Billy.
Yeah, we have this a lot where we like talk to sort of tech products and like, oh, okay, well, we'll solve a problem, and then we don't understand why like people don't love us. And you're like, well, because you don't really give a shit. Like you connect A to B with a smart user interface, and then you wonder why you don't have any retention or you know, people that care. And it's like, because you don't care. Like, you don't care enough about the actual problems of why someone's trying to solve this problem. And I do think that all of the kind of the companies that blow up, they either do something no one's done before at scale that's never been done before, which, you know, good luck if you've unearthed that gem, fair play to you. You're probably a genius. Or they just go way beyond caring. And in terms of like, okay, what's the why behind what? Like, I'm not a vehicle to move money from X to Y. I am an understanding that the reason that this couple are moving that money is because they have to spend 40K on IVF or whatever it might be. What can we add on top of that? And yeah, the idea of a concierge service and sort of, by the way, here's all the legal stuff you need as well, all in one place, is just such an understanding of that kind of full why that we try and sort of advocate for all of our clients, whatever it is, and quite often get met with blank faces where we're just like, you don't understand enough about your business to be creating content or marketing because you don't really give that enough of a fuck about the people that use your service. And so yeah, just to sort of double down on like awesome product, awesome work, and we love it. With that in mind, would love to hear maybe any particular success stories you can share from your work with Daylight, like anything that's really just made you think, yes, like I'm so glad we started this. This is what gets me out of bed in the morning.
Yeah, you know, in general, like our customers get me out of bed in the morning. Hearing stories, particularly with the chosen name feature early on, about you know, I am trans, but I haven't updated my legal name, and I started a new job, and I'm going for coffee with my coworkers, and, you know, the Square readers now just pull first name off the card, and they read off, you know, when your coffee order's ready, they just read off that. I had one customer message us and say, you know, well, you have basically allowed me the freedom to go have coffee with my coworkers and connect with them as people and not be beholden to technology in this way. Basically saved me a really embarrassing and alienating process. Stories like that really just make me feel very validated that this was like a useful product for people. Cause you know, like there's always that fear when you build something, even if you think it's really cool, even if you've done all the user testing in the world, that you might put it out into the world and no one really values it or no one finds it useful. And then, you know, Daylight Grow, the family building product, is pretty early still, but already hearing stories about how much more empowered, how much more ready people feel to start this you know, very overwhelming and scary journey. And yeah, it just feels, it feels really good when we get to do those things. I think the White House was another big kind of moment for us, just in terms of, you know, we are not an advocacy organization. We're not a nonprofit, but it's like, holy shit, we're at the White House. Like we are in those rooms. We're having those conversations with people who can make real societal change. And we have a voice in that room. Yeah. Feels incredibly, incredibly cool.
Who did you like the most when you're at the White House?
I didn't get to go to the White House. That was my co-founder. I was invited and I was going to go. And then I ended up having to go to a meeting on the other side of the country. And I was so annoyed that I missed that one, but I get all the juicy goss from my co-founder when he's in the meeting.
Yeah, I was going to say, who did your co-founder text you that they're like, oh my God, so-and-so is so cool. Who was that person?
I can't actually remember. But yeah, it just in general was like a very fun experience.
I feel like Jill would be the coolest, like the first lady. Actually, yeah,
yeah. You'd go for a beer with most of the Bidens. Like they seem like they'd just be like, hey, son, you need to knuckle down.
Buckaroo. None of that malarkey.
Yeah.
That's the Bidens. Curious to hear a bit more, like digging into the product. Like obviously the audience is one of the things that makes, you know, Daylight so unique, and you've got Daylight Money, you've got Daylight Grow, but would love to hear, like, have you been able to sort of embed any other interesting innovations into the product itself, features that you want to shout about? Just curious about that.
It's a good question. You know, I, aside from the ones I've kind of already mentioned, which is really boils down to kind of chosen name features in general and kind of identity flexibility on the app.
Or any on the roadmap that are coming, if you want to preview.
I'm not sure I can give away my secrets. One of the things we think a lot about is how we could bring in existing traditions like mutual aid and community support into a technology environment. And so, you know, I've talked about it before. We never managed to build it for the neobank. Maybe we will eventually, but I actually think there's a version of this that could exist for the Grow product that essentially boils down to the idea of like a mutual aid savings account or something like that. Like GoFundMe is the number one way in which people afford their transitions at the moment in the US, like it more than health insurance. And GoFundMe takes a fee. It's public. You have to sort of publicly ask for money and, you know, monetize your transition in this kind of way that has never really sat super well with me. You know, what would it be like if we could build that feature into your banking app or into your family building product? That kind of thing is very exciting to me. There's a very cool product called CoFertility. I'm not sure if you're familiar, but they do egg freezing where if you don't want to or can't afford to pay for your egg freezing, you can donate a portion of your eggs to a family that want the eggs for five, yeah, for surrogacy. And I think that kind of thing is just such a cool idea because those are practices that the queer community have been doing forever. Like my co-founder has talked about this publicly many times, so he won't mind me talking about it, but like he's been a donor for a lesbian couple, and you know this idea of kind of mutually supporting one another's family aspirations is something that exists in a very sort of localized and manual way. And so wouldn't it be so cool if we could build some of those practices into the app?
Yeah, that's really cool. It's also like the true essence of potentially the sharing economy, which obviously has been sort of abused as a term and you know, unfortunate ways, but that's really powerful.
Yeah. And again, just like, you know, thinking of all the different next steps and next issues and just bringing them all into one product is just, yeah, very, very cool. Moving more to your personal journey in the tech industry, what's that been like? I noticed when I was looking at your Twitter that you had musician listed. Would very much like to hear more about that. And just, yeah, maybe your personal journey through tech that sort of started from out of school all the way to here founding Daylight and making a great success out of it.
Sure. My journey with tech started when I was about 10, and my school very randomly, this was way before this was like a thing that anyone did, my school taught us to code. So this would have been in like 2000, 2001. So like way before this was a thing. And so I was one of those kind of nerdy kids that spent their lunch times coding in the library. That was kind of it was either that or I was in wind band or in choir. That was how I spent my lunch time. So those were my two kind of, those were and are my two great loves, tech and music. And I ended up studying music at university because I grew up in a very chill family that was basically like, whatever you want to do, go do that. And so I ended up with a bachelor's degree in pop music, of all things. And I have very mixed feelings on whether that was like really excellent parenting or just like someone should have been like, hey, do you really want a degree in pop music?
I don't know how, but somehow it's both. So
yes, it is. To be fair, if anyone had ever said to me, don't do that, I would not have listened to them. I've always been a very stubborn and headstrong person. I was a musician for a number of years, and that was kind of, you know, what I was doing with my life. And I had this great idea that, you know, music was kind of my only thing that could truly make me happy, but doesn't pay very well. So on the side, I would make websites for people. That was kind of always my side hustle. And I moved to New York to pursue music and immediately realized how expensive New York was. And I ended up getting asked to build a website for Anthemis Group, who are a fintech VC in London and New York. And they offered me a job off the back of that. And to be honest, I accepted the job because I needed health insurance and I kind of wanted a salary rather than like freelancer wages. And it was a huge, like, I consider that a really big light bulb moment for me, in addition, because I'd never really thought about tech as a career. I guess I probably knew about startups, but I'd never really engaged with startups and had no idea what fintech was. I think I probably had Venmo downloaded on my phone, but that was like the closest thing to fintech that I had ever touched. From then on, I realized that actually there was a ton of creative fulfillment to be had in startups, in fintech, and it's really just putting your creative brain on a different set of problems. And then I decided I wanted to be a real software engineer. And so I went and did a coding bootcamp, did my time at like Techstars, a crypto startup, before kind of wanting to start my own startup. And that was really because I've always struggled with being told how to spend my time. And I've always struggled with, if I don't think that a problem is really interesting to solve, I don't really have the energy or the desire to solve it. And so if it's something that's just kind of boring or something that someone else thinks is really interesting, it never really works for me. So I wanted to kind of do my own thing. And I'd built this app that was a two-sided marketplace for trans and non-binary people to access safe spaces, inspired by my own experiences transitioning in New York and traveling 3 hours to find a gender-affirming laser hair removal clinic. And it was one of those things where I'd found the clinic because a trans woman that I followed on Tumblr had offhandedly mentioned it 8 pages back in her blog. And I happened to look at it and be like, oh, that's where I can go to be safe because she's had a good experience there. And I was like, there has to be a better way to centralize this information. And so that was really my first time building anything for myself. That was my first time building something for my community. And also really, previous to that, I'd always really downplayed my identity as well, and either not brought it up to the people that I worked with or left it as like a, you know, this is not an important part of my identity. And so that was kind of a huge moment. And that is what led me to meeting my future co-founder, Rob. And then, you know, about a year after that, I started building Daylight with him.
That's such a cool journey. And I love, like, schools get so much shit when they do those kind of things. But, like, you know, 20 years ago, like, that school taking that coding camp ultimately led to a lifelong passion that created Daylight. So, yeah, it's really cool to see that kind of butterfly effect all the way through your career.
We'd love to hear about the biggest frustration that you found in the industry or just kind of like a core challenge that you're experiencing now.
For me, being a software engineer was not fun. Because it remains an incredibly male-dominated field. And I kind of arrogantly came into it being like, this is going to be fine. Like, I'm going to brute force my way into receiving respect. And I got, like, there were a number of times, like, when I was working at the crypto startup, I was building out their front end by myself. Probably a position I was not super qualified to have, but like, you know, I was doing it. Like, yeah. I was figuring it out.
A startup, you say?
Yeah, I mean, it was a startup. You know, it's like, it doesn't really matter how qualified you are. But I got mistaken as the receptionist a number of times by like investors and by people very high up in tech. Never, obviously, you know, the people that I worked with were incredibly supportive, but it made me super aware of, you know, I'm wearing kind of like a wrinkled shirt right now, but like in general, I'm a pretty feminine presenting person. Like I love a flowery sundress. I have long hair. And I realized that like for a sort of industry, for a field that prides itself on objectivity and rational thinking and like this is code and it's unemotional and stuff, my experience was heavily affected by people's perceptions of me, which is like a subjective thing, whether people trusted my ability to my authority and my intelligence was incredibly frustrating. And, you know, I know all women software engineers in particular, like have talked about, you know, talk about this phenomenon. I think the one that really was the kind of the clincher for me, and I think is one of the special parts of being trans, is you sort of get to experience it on both sides of the coin. And one of my very close friends, who's a trans woman, she got to sort of senior software engineer before she transitioned. And so being sort of perceived as a man. And after she transitioned, despite the fact that she'd been at this company for like 6 years, she was suddenly having every single decision that she made questioned. She was having her authority questioned. No one was trusting her all of a sudden just because she presented in a very different way. And yeah, you know, it's you know, I'm pretty sure I haven't looked at this latest year's statistics, but pretty much every year, the number of women in sort of software engineering goes down. And the reason for it is like, it's just brutal. Like it's just a deeply, deeply unpleasant experience.
I feel like people don't talk enough when like, you know, we're skirting around this idea of like imposter syndrome, right? Which we always talk about it as like living in the, you know, the mind or heart of the, you know, person from the non-dominant group that's kind of in the space of the other group. But it's like, we don't talk enough about the demand side of it, of these like entitled idiots who make people feel like they shouldn't be there or like they haven't earned it or that they're not, you know, skilled enough to be there, and just sort of like putting out that energy to put the ideas in our head that like we actually maybe don't belong there. It's just absolutely like that's the thing we need to fix, is like kind of, you know, the demand side of it. And like these people who they're coming into workplaces and schools with this impression of like, well, why would a woman be doing this, or why would a person of color be doing this? And it's just, it's absurd, you know? So I think, yeah, I'd like to see more focus on like, you know, getting people, you know, to a place where you can walk into a workplace and they don't have these prejudices, they don't have these biases, you know?
Yeah, I don't have imposter syndrome. Everyone else, I have imposter perception syndrome, yeah, which is that other people view me as an imposter. I know that I'm smart and capable, and it's that frustrating that like, it's almost like a form of, it's a very hot take, it's almost kind of a form of dysphoria or something, where people are viewing you one way, but you know internally that you are, you know, that you are different to that. Yeah. But I totally agree. It needs to be dismantled.
I do not have that inner belief. So big jealousy there. I'm like, when people are like, you shouldn't be here, I'm like, fuck oh, yeah, I believe you, bro. No, yeah, I think the other thing as well, like we spoke about it quite a lot on the podcast, is just like, so many of the world's problems are like, you realize where they come from when you realize that the vast majority of the world's tech is built by 35-year-old white men. And I say that as a 35-year-old white man, but I'm aware of the limitations of my people. And you know, like we've spoken about before, it's like, how do I get fast food quicker, like, rather than how do I create a banking app that like affirms people's identities and makes them live safer lives? That's fucking cool. Let's invest in that. Not, hey, how can I take my getting a cab, already quite an easy process, from 5 minutes to 2 minutes? Like, it's such a disconnect between the demand and the development, and like what's important and what's prioritized.
Shall we jump into
lightning round?
Yeah, lightning round.
Hell yeah, yeah. Lightning round. Let's do it. Mm-hmm. We should probably transition that slightly better than that.
We're usually better at that. So lightning round basically is, you know, we ask you slightly like cheekier, interesting, personal questions just about you, just to give the audience a bit more insight into who you are as a human. So what's been one game-changing piece of tech in your life?
Ooh, I should have thought about this more in advance.
We sent you the questions, Billy. We tried.
What is the most game-changing piece of tech? I mean, the only thing I can think of is like my phone, I guess, which is not a very interesting thing. But like, you know, the fact that you can do almost anything on your phone is pretty game-changing, I guess.
Besides daylight, what app on your phone do you find yourself like going back to the most?
I do not have social media on my phone because it's too addictive.
That's great.
So I cannot do that. I honestly look at my to-do app a lot. Like I'm very much like a devotee of Todoist and my calendar, honestly, because I'm one of those people that I never really know what's happening each day, but I know that if it's in my calendar, I will show up for it. Or if it's in my to-do list, I will get it done.
Yeah.
So I've sort of just like outsourced having to think about those things to that tech, which is pretty nice.
There is a to-do list where the more you do and fulfill your to-do list, you have a little like gaming avatar that levels up like a Pokemon.
Oh yeah, I've seen this. I
keep meaning to get it, and that's awesome. it's just one of the like most wholesome like ideas I've ever heard. I was just like, I could fully get on board with that, and you can like battle other people who have a to-do list,
like get stronger, like
get stronger, and like you can choose it to give it little like outfits and stuff. It's just whoever came up with that like just lives a good life.
Tamagotchi to-do list.
Moving on to the next question. What's one problem tech can't solve for us and why?
This is a hot take given what we're building, but I do not believe that tech can fully solve human connection. Mm. And I believe that it can facilitate human connection, but I'm very bullish on the sort of mechanism of in real life connection and interaction over anything else. Because if tech could solve that, we wouldn't all feel lonely and isolated in our apartments.
Hear me out though. I just saw an article today about a Chinese tool that was just developed. It's like you each buy one and it's lips, and you kiss the lips, and then it simulates the way your partner kisses, because it's like taking the data from how your partner kisses their thing, and then you kiss your thing, and then you kind of just, and apparently it's like, you know, just like a smoocher or something.
Do you
like
remember
that.
The part where Billy said not feeling lonely?
Fair enough.
Is there anything lonelier than kissing artificial lips?
It looks pretty bad.
It's pretty sad, that is
not a tech
it's grim.
That's not a problem tech can solve for.
That's a tech can't save us example. That
leads nicely onto the next question.
This is our tech for bad question, Billy. What's the evilest application of tech that you've seen out there?
I think it's got to be the technology that tracks students' eyes when they're doing tests. I don't know if you've seen this, but it's like Proctor like software. So it basically is like trying to tell if the person taking an exam online is looking at notes or looking at a different screen or something, and it pulls a bunch of like false negatives or false positives because you can't quantify human eye movement in the way that they think you can when you're doing things like thinking and solving a problem. And so, really anything that seeks to kind of take human physicality and kind of quantify it for means of kind of control, I think is deeply evil. Also just like drones as like a pretty obvious one too.
Yeah. Drones is like I'm like drones. Yeah.
I find like Microsoft Teams is a bit like that, because like the people I know who are on Microsoft Teams, they have to always be active, otherwise their Teams thing shows as inactive.
Right.
And that's like a big no-no, and everyone's like, you're not doing any work. It's like, well, I could just be fucking, you know, writing or going for like, you know,
I heard there's apps though, like someone was talking about like an app or a tool that will like move your mouse or like at least present.
If you just chuck a YouTube video on it'll play, and like there's a whole way we're smarter than Microsoft Teams.
The
core concept behind it I don't like it. Next question. You've already dreamt up a couple of awesome tech products. If you could create another new one, what problem would it solve and for whom?
I was actually thinking about this yesterday before I even saw this question. I would love WeWork or something similar, like I'm in a WeWork right now, to have podcast rooms that you could rent by the hour, because it's so annoying having to find like quiet space. And you know, I have a mic at home, but I do not like, I'm always on the road and that kind of thing. So I just like, you know, you have to listen to me through my laptop microphone with the resonance and the echo. And I think I would do, it's probably a very, very niche product, but there's also probably a very easy acquisition opportunity for like WeWork or literally any kind of co-working space rent a podcast room that's soundproof and has a nice mic that you can literally just plug into a laptop.
Yeah, it's a really good shout. We use Hubble as like a global, you know, sort of booking platform for co-working spaces. We were just saying the other day, like, we wish we could, you know, once you book a place, book a podcast room or book a meeting room within that space instead of just renting the space. I'm sure they'll add it to the roadmap, but it makes a ton of sense.
I would love it if someone stole that.
We've seen a couple of independent co-working spaces that have podcast rooms, but then it's just not easy to use it. It's like a co-working space that's like one building and no chain. All of the major chains seem to try and like give you as little it looks as cool as possible, but then in terms of actual facilities, you're just like, why is there no call rooms ever free, let alone a podcast studio?
Yeah.
Some of the co-working spaces are really just like lobbies with chairs, and we're like, come on, guys, like this is not, you know.
Yeah, one time we went, I went to one, and it was just the back half of a cafe. There was just like a little, there was just like a little rope that distinguished, this is the front half of the cafe where you buy a coffee.
It's the empanada place.
This is the back half. The
empanada place in Dalston.
Absolutely ludicrous.
What's a, we like to ask this because, you know, as a founder, you're seeing, you're talking to funders, you're talking to users, you know, of your platform, and you're in the work. So we'd love to just hear a prediction that you have about, you know, it could be the space that you're in, you know, sort of neobanks, you know, fintech, things like that, the LGBTQ space or tech broadly. But yeah, what's a prediction that you have for the coming year?
I think we're going to see a ton of consolidation across startups in general, but particularly fintech. We have basically an entire industry that is propped up on matchsticks through consumer behavior. We have eroded consumer trust over the last couple of weeks in particular. And you have a ton of B2B like SaaS products that are only functioning because other B2B SaaS products are using them. So it's this like snake eating its own tail. And I think it's not a very positive or inspiring prediction, but I think we're going to see a ton of roll-ups.
Yeah, that's probably the most specific answer we've ever had to that question. Yeah. So yeah, appreciate that. Normally it's just like, yeah, VCs are gonna stop lending money, and you're like, okay, cool. Yeah, no shit. Like that seems super in the weeds. Let's all watch out for that. Taking us out on a nice positive note, what's worked well for you in terms of building a career in tech that sort of balances both profit and purpose?
I think it really boils down to honesty and transparency. It's a lesson that we learn early on, kind of the hard way, which was through, I think we started off with a company and a team that really wanted to believe that this was like a pure purpose company. And we had to do a lot of work to take people on a journey to, this is actually a for-profit business. And that is important because that's the way that we stay alive and the way that we continue to serve our customers. But we do not stay alive unless we make money. I would love that to not be the case. I would love to somehow be able to just like take VC money and give it directly to our community. That's just not how any of these systems work. But what I've noticed is the more I'm honest and transparent about that as our core motive for this company, or our core kind of priority, I suppose, it actually yields much better results because people respect that honesty. What they don't respect is, you know, trying to pretend that you're something that you're not. And in general, in my career, I found that kind of, you know, you've probably sort of noticed it throughout this, even this interview, is like, I'm very, very transparent about the way I made decisions, the things that I was up against. I do not do the kind of glossing over, making things feel or sound. It really frustrates me when people talk about their journey and make it seem like it was like totally easy and everything just fell into their lap. And I want to get into like, I'm like, how did you pay your bills for the 3 months that you didn't have a job while you were soul searching? Like I always want to get like really detailed there. And so for me, it's really important, particularly when I'm talking to like new founders or young founders, to talk about like the actual numbers, the actual reality, because that's the only way that we can sort of progress as a society and we can create more equality in our society is being like, hey, you know, like, my founder salary when I was running this like early stage was like 52K. Like that, you know, we had to figure out how to live off that in America, which is not, you know, it's pretty difficult.
In New York.
And that kind of thing. Yeah. I ended up moving to rural Virginia, which was how I made that work. But yeah.
That is one solution.
Yeah. No. Yeah.
I think that's super interesting what you said, because we work with a lot of, like, we purely work with mission-driven startups and nonprofits. And one thing we're noticing is good nonprofits are focusing more on how they become more like a company, and good companies are focusing on how they become more like a nonprofit. Like, there's almost a sort of meeting in the middle. Like, all the nonprofits we've met in the last 5 years that have been founded, they're like, how do we get to a point where we self-sustain as quickly as possible, and then any donations are a little added bonus on the side, like, rather than sort of like the traditional charity model of we just live handout to handout and we build an entire sales team looking at that. So yeah, it's interesting to sort of see charity and non-charity sector kind of almost heading towards the same middle ground.
Yeah, there's a freedom in that, so that self-sustainability.
Cool. Well, Billy, this has been a fantastic conversation. We really appreciate, first of all the work you're doing with Daylight, and it's like an incredible product, the grow side, the money side, really impressive. And it's your tribute to the ways that tech can actually save us, despite the name of the podcast. You caught on to the irony of it. So, we're just really grateful for your time. So thank you for jumping on today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah. And where can folks find out more about Daylight on the interwebs?
The website is joindaylight, joindaylight.com. I'm not really on social media. I have a Twitter that I like once every 6 months decide to tweet on, which is Billy_Simmons_, I believe. But yeah. Google Daylight. We do lots of events at the moment. That's kind of our latest thing, is like weekly webinars on different domain-specific topics. So come and join us at an event. And thanks so much again.
So you have a nice fertility law event that's like kind of like today, tomorrow, at some point, but looks really cool. And check it out, folks. By the time this publishes, that'll be done. But I'm sure there'll be more events coming up. So
it will.
Yeah. Well, Billy Simmons, co-founder of Daylight, thank you so much for joining us today. We really appreciate your time. Have a good one.